Part 2. The Reich Consolidates. Chapter 6. The Rat Lines. Considering the vast economic resources at their disposal, especially if they held dark secrets concerning advanced technology such as tactical nukes, flying saucers, or a device for manipulating energy, it is now certain that the surviving Nazi leadership wielded enough power to misdirect investigations and silence foreign governments and news organizations. There remain long-standing controversies over the proclaimed deaths of prominent Nazis, including Martin Bormann. The notorious SS doctor Josef Mengele, the Angel of Extermination at Auschwitz, and Gestapo Chief SS Gruppenführer Heinrich Gestapo Müller. According to various unsubstantiated reports, Mengele suffered a stroke while swimming and drowned in Brazil in 1979 after hiding there, as well as in Argentina and Paraguay, for decades. Another ranking SS official, Obersturmbannführer Adolf Eichmann, escaped to Argentina but was abducted to Israel in 1960, where he was convicted of war crimes and executed. Toward the end of the war, Müller distanced himself from his boss, Himmler, and moved closer to Bormann. After he slipped away from Hitler's bunker in the last days of the Reich, Müller's family declared him dead and erected a tombstone in a Berlin cemetery with the inscription, "Our Dear Daddy." However, in 1963, a court-ordered exhumation revealed that the grave contained three skeletons, none of which matched Müller's height or bone structure. But the biggest fish to get away was Reichsleiter Bormann, the ultimate power behind the Nazi super science projects and the architect of Operation Eagle Flight. In 1972, Munich Bishop Johannes Neuhausler made public a post-war church document stating that Bormann had escaped Berlin during the final days and gone to Spain by airplane. The next year, after journalist Paul Manning published an article in the New York Times detailing Bormann's escape from justice, West German officials held a news conference proclaiming that Berlin workmen had unearthed two skeletons near the ruins of the Lehrter railroad station and that one of the skeletons had been identified as Bormann. He died in 1945 trying to escape Berlin, they stated. However, the entire case for the Berlin death of Bormann rested on dental records prepared from memory by a dentist who had been a loyal Nazi for many years and the sole statement of a dental technician who had been imprisoned in Russia due to his proclaimed knowledge of Bormann's dental work. Adding to suspicions that Bormann's death announcement was most convenient for anyone wishing to cover Bormann's tracks was the fact that Willy Brandt's government cancelled all rewards and warrants for Bormann and instructed West German embassies and consulates to ignore any future sightings of the Reichsleiter. These suspicions were compounded by statements from several persons who told Paul Manning that the body found near the railroad station was placed there in 1945 by SS troops commanded by Gestapo Müller, who was known to have used decoy bodies on other occasions. Bormann's death notice did not convince the late Simon Wiesenthal of the Documentation Center in Vienna, who said, "Some doubts must remain whether the bones found in Berlin are really those of Bormann." One of Bormann's relatives had no doubts. In 1947, Walter Buch, the father of Bormann's wife, Gerda, declared on his deathbed, "That damn Martin made it safely out of Germany." According to Manning, Bormann was escorted from dying Berlin by selected SS men who passed him along a series of safe houses to Munich, where he hid out with his brother, Albert. In early 1946, Bormann was escorted on foot over the Alps to the northern Italian seaport of Genoa. There, Bormann was housed in a Franciscan monastery. All this was arranged by Gestapo Müller. In mid-1946, a steamership carried Bormann, provided with false identification papers, to Spain, where he entered the Dominican monastery of San Domingos in the province of Galicia, once the home of Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, a supposed neutral who covertly supported Hitler. Manning noted that in 1969, when Bormann became aware that Israeli agents were sniffing along his escape route, there was a fire in San Domingos. Curiously, the fire started on the very shelves where the monastery kept its book of visitors, which contained Bormann's name. This incriminating record, suspiciously, was destroyed. In the winter of 1947, a large freighter carrying Bormann and several SS officers anchored in the harbor of Buenos Aires, where an organized network of supporters awaited them. Even before the shooting war ended, lesser-known SS members and hardcore Nazis were fanning out across the world through covert distribution systems. The means was a loosely knit collection of escape routes from Europe called ratlines. Chief among these ratlines were the Kameradenwerk and the Odessa, the Organisation der ehemaligen SS Angehörigen, or the Organization of Former SS Members. Odessa was created by Bormann and Müller, and later administered by Otto Skorzeny, who had escaped war crimes convictions. Documentation of these ratlines is so incomplete and fragmentary that some historians, taking their cue from the corporate world, have denied that Odessa existed outside the fevered dreams of fanatical SS men. Ladislaus Fargo, author of popular histories as well as an acclaimed biography of General George Patton, also wrote that he had proof of Bormann's post-war survival. He acknowledged Odessa's existence, but wrote it was actually little more than a shadowy consortium of a handful of freelancers and never amounted to much in the Nazi underground. But then, in 1976, Louis L. Snyder, professor of history at the City College and the City University of New York, produced the mammoth Encyclopedia of the Third Reich. Snyder described Odessa as a vast clandestine Nazi travel organization to aid the escape of SS members and top Nazis. He noted that the main terminal point for Odessa was Buenos Aires. According to Farrago, the Kameradenwerk was the real focal point for escaping Nazis. It was founded by Luftwaffe Colonel Hans Ulrich Rudel, an air ace who lost a leg flying 2,530 combat missions for Germany. After the war, Rudel almost alone put together one of the most far-reaching and best-financed of the rescue groups, the Kameradenwerk. Rudel's group had help, but according to Farrago, it did not come from the Bormann underground, but from the vast organization and the enormous resources of the one agency that, in the end, took care of more Nazis than all the others combined, the Refugee Bureau of the Vatican. To understand the seemingly puzzling relationship between Hitler's Nazis and the Holy Roman Church, one must look back to a 1929 agreement signed between the Vatican and the government of Fascist Italy. Under this concordat, known as the Lateran Treaty, the Italian government bought favor from the Church by paying almost 1 billion lire in gold as compensation for church property taken during the 19th century Risorgimento, or reorganization, that helped create modern Italy. The Lateran Treaty also established Vatican City in Rome as a sovereign state, as well as making Roman Catholicism the only state religion in Italy. On July 20, 1933, a similar concordat was reached between Pope Pius XI and Nazi Germany. Treaty negotiations were handled by Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, who signed on behalf of the Pope and later became Pope Pius XII. This concordat, still in effect today, was signed by Franz von Papen on behalf of German President Paul von Hindenburg. Von Papen was tried at Nuremberg, but released despite being denounced as a primary mover in Hitler's aggression in Europe. According to the 1933 Concordat, there was to be no interference by the Church in political affairs. It also required all bishops to take a loyalty oath to the state and required all priests to be German citizens and subordinate to government officials. Prior to the Concordat's ratification, the Nazi government also reached similar agreements with the major Protestant churches. Hitler, who at a young age trained at a Catholic monastery school and strived to reach accommodations with the German churches, once proclaimed, I believe today that my conduct is in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator. Rumors have circulated for years that a secret codicil of the Concordat involved papal leniency toward National Socialism in exchange for Catholicism being proclaimed the state religion of Europe after an appropriate period of time of total Nazi control. Regardless, it mattered little, as Hitler quickly took steps against all churches, including the Catholics. His sterilization laws, attempts to dissolve the Catholic Youth League, and arrests of priests, nuns, and lay leaders all angered the Catholic community. In March 1937, Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical letter titled Mit brennender Sorge, or With Burning Sorrow. In the letter, the Pope accused the Nazis of both violating and evading the Concordat, and even foresaw threatening storm clouds of war and extermination. A year later, Pius XI addressed the Nazi persecution of the Jews by proclaiming worldwide, "Mark well that in the Catholic Mass, Abraham is our patriarch and forefather. Antisemitism is incompatible with the lofty thought which that fact expresses. I say to you, it is impossible for a Christian to take part in antisemitism. It is inadmissible. Through Christ and in Christ, we are the spiritual progeny of Abraham. Spiritually, we are all Semites." But if Pius XI's turn against National Socialism was legitimate, it unfortunately was short-lived. On February 10, 1939, the day before Pius XI was scheduled to deliver yet another scathing public attack on fascism and antisemitism, he died, reportedly of a massive heart attack. Copies of his planned anti-fascist speech have never been found. Vatican officials have stated they may have been misfiled. Rumors implicated Dr. Francesco Severio Petacci in the Pope's sudden death. Petacci, one of the Vatican physicians at the time, was the father of Clara Petacci, the longtime mistress of fascist leader Benito Mussolini. The whispers were that Petacci gave the Pope an injection that caused his fatal attack. Strong support for this rumor came some years later when the same allegation was found in the personal diary of French cardinal and former French army intelligence agent Eugène Tisserand. Pope Pius XII, born Eugenio Maria Giuseppe Giovanni Pacelli, was certainly less antagonistic toward fascism and, in fact, had been an honored guest at the society wedding of Clara Petacci and Italian Air Force Lieutenant Riccardo Federici in 1934. The marriage did not last long, and Clara was soon visiting Mussolini at night via a secret staircase in the Palazzo Venezia. Catholic historian and journalist John Cornwell, in 1999, stunned the Catholic world with his book, Hitler's Pope. A former seminary student, Cornwell explained that he originally intended to defend the actions of Pope Pius XII, but as his research in Vatican archives progressed, his attitude changed. By the middle of 1997, nearing the end of my research, I found myself in a state I can only describe as moral shock. The material I had gathered, taking the more extensive view of Pacelli's life, amounted not to an exoneration, but to a wider indictment, Cornwell wrote. The author eventually saw that this Pope's actions, or inaction, actually aided in Hitler's rise to power and the ensuing Holocaust. Needless to say, Cornwell's perception was immediately and savagely attacked as inaccurate reporting and misinterpretation. In the December 9, 2004 edition of The Economist, Cornwell waffled, writing, "I would now argue, in light of the debates and evidence following Hitler's Pope, that Pius XII had so little scope of action that it is impossible to judge the motives for his silence during the war, while Rome was under the heel of Mussolini and later occupied by Germany. Regardless of motives, it is historical fact that many top Nazis and SS men escaped Europe with passports issued by Catholic officials." Luftwaffe ace Rudel admitted as much in 1970, stating, in Rome itself, the transit point of the escape routes, a vast amount was done. With its own immense resources, the church helped many of us to go overseas. One of those helpful clerics was Bishop Alois Hudel, who voiced opinions comparable to those of Hitler's Viennese friend Jörg Lanz von Liebenfels, publisher of Ostara, a magazine with occult and erotic themes. A Cistercian monk who founded the anti-Semitic Secret Order of the New Templars, von Liebenfels and his mentor Guido von List sought to revive the medieval brotherhood of Teutonic Knights, those heroes of Hitler's youth who had used the swastika as an emblem. While von Liebenfels headed his Order of the New Templars, Bishop Hudel was named Procurator General of the Catholic Order of German Knights. On May 1, 1933, in a Nazi-sanctioned celebration of the pagan Walpurgis holiday, Hudel made a particularly impassioned speech in Rome before assembled church and Nazi leaders, as well as the expatriate German community. "German unity is my strength. My strength is German might," he told the crowd. It was, in fact, a Franciscan friar serving under Bishop Hudel who helped arrange a Red Cross passport and visa to Argentina in 1950 for Obersturmbannführer Adolf Eichmann, the exterminator of Jews who had managed to slip away from American captors at the end of the war. Bishop Hudel, in his later memoirs, thanked God he was able to help so many escape with false identity papers. Many of these false identity papers were documents issued by the Commissione Pontificia d'Assistenza, or the Vatican Refugee Organization. While not full passports themselves, these Vatican identity papers were used to obtain a displaced person passport from the International Red Cross, which, in turn, was used to gain a visa. Supposedly, the Red Cross checked the backgrounds of applicants, but usually it was sufficient to have the word of a priest or a bishop. This method of aiding escaping Nazis, the one favored by Bishop Hudel, came to be known as the Vatican Ratlines. For example, Ante Pavelić, the wartime pro-Nazi fascist dictator of Croatia, who was given a private audience with Pope Pius XII shortly after taking power in 1941, escaped to South America after the war with a Red Cross passport gained through a Vatican document. One of the countries in which the Auslandsorganisation worked with particular success was Argentina. There it has been able to operate without any disguise or front. All of the more than 200,000 Argentine Nazis are members not of an Argentine sub-organization of the Nazi Party, but of the German Party itself, and hold membership cards signed by Robert Ley, leader of the German Workers' Front, which means quite obviously that Berlin considered, and still considers, Argentina not so much an independent foreign country as a German Gau, district, noted Kurt Ries. Although many Nazis found safe haven in Brazil, Paraguay, Chile, and Uruguay, no South American nation was more accommodating than the Argentina of dictator Juan Domingo Perón and his lovely second wife, Eva Maria Duarte de Perón, popularly known as Evita. After participating in a successful military coup in 1943, Perón was voted in as president in 1946 by a majority of voters who lauded his efforts to eliminate poverty and dignify workers. He was elected against the intense and overt opposition of the United States. Such opposition appeared justified, for soon after his election, Perón began to nationalize and expropriate British and American businesses. As their influence in Argentina dwindled, that of the Germans grew. Luftwaffe pilot Rudel, who created the Kameradenwerk ratline, became a trainer for Perón's Air Force and in the process brought with him about 100 members of the wartime Luftwaffe staff. Likewise, many Nazi SS and Gestapo fugitives from justice served in the Argentine army and police forces. Among them was Kurt Tank, who headed a large group of Nazi scientists. Tank, a fighter plane designer and former director of the Focke-Wulf aircraft factory, had slipped away from Germany in disguise and, armed with false identity papers provided by Perón himself, arrived in Buenos Aires with microfilm of aircraft designs hidden in his pants. Soon, about 60 of his old Nazi comrades had joined him using the same system. The man most responsible for fostering pro-Nazi feelings in South America was General Wilhelm von Faupel. In 1900, Faupel went to China as a member of the German military legation. He later went to Moscow in the same capacity. In 1911, he joined the staff of the Argentine War College in Buenos Aires. Faupel returned to Argentina after serving Germany in World War I and obtained the job of military counselor to the Inspector General of the Argentine Army. Von Faupel not only imparted military theories to the armies of Argentina, Brazil, and Peru, he also instilled in them the political theories of National Socialism. Hating the Weimar Republic passionately, he did not return to Germany until the Nazis were about to take power, wrote Kurt Ries. But while he was away, he kept up excellent relations with industrialists such as Fritz Thyssen, Georg von Schnitzler, and Herr von Schroeder. After all, these gentlemen had elaborate interests in Latin America. And so had von Faupel. In fact, he boasted openly among German military and industrial men that he could conquer the whole of Latin America. Faupel most likely was speaking for many globalists who had significant holdings in South America and did not wish to relinquish them to leftists, communists, nationalists, or reformers. Although he is widely seen as a dictator, many Peronists still view Juan Perón as a champion of the working man. Few realized at the time that he was stashing away an estimated $500 million in Swiss bank accounts. According to Manning, at least $100 million came from the Bormann organization. Perón reciprocated for this generosity by allowing many war criminals to immigrate, legally and illegally, to Argentina. He reportedly provided more than 1,000 blank passports for escaping Nazis. Perón was an admirer of Hitler. He had learned German at a young age so he could read Mein Kampf. His private secretary, Rudolfo Freuda, also was chief of internal security. The Argentine dictator was greatly honored to shelter Deputy Führer Bormann. After several low-key meetings with Bormann, Perón saw Bormann's flight capital program as a means of boosting the Argentine economy. Both realized that the capture of Bormann was a clear and ever-present danger, noted Paul Manning, and so Perón instructed the chief of his secret police to give all possible cooperation to Heinrich Müller in his task of protecting the party minister, a collaboration that continued for years. Evita took on the role of liaison between her husband and Nazis seeking asylum. Born in 1919 as an illegitimate child, she became a prostitute to survive and to get acting roles, wrote investigative reporter Georg Hodel. As she climbed the social ladder, lover by lover, she built up deep resentments toward the traditional elites. As a mistress to other army officers, she caught the eye of handsome military strongman Juan Perón. After a public love affair, they married in 1945. In June 1947, Eva Perón embarked on a much-publicized rainbow tour of Europe, greeted royally by Spain's Franco and a private audience with Pope Pius XII. While in Spain, she reportedly met with Otto Skorzeny, who headed a rat line known as Die Spinne, or the Spider, and arranged the transfer of millions in Nazi loot to Argentina. She also traveled to Genoa, where she met with Argentine shipping fleet owner Alberto Dodero, who within a month was ferrying Nazis to South America. But the primary purpose of the trip appeared to be the meetings Evita held with bankers in Switzerland. According to records now emerging from Swiss archives and the investigations of Nazi hunters, an unpublicized side of Evita's world tour was coordinating the network for helping Nazis relocate in Argentina, wrote Hodel. Though Evita's precise role on organizing the Nazi rat lines remains a bit fuzzy, her European tour connected the dots of the key figures in the escape network. She also helped clear the way for more formal arrangements in the Swiss-Argentine-Nazi collaboration. In 1955, Perón was ousted in a military coup and forced to flee to neighboring Paraguay and later to exile in Madrid, Spain. He left without the body of Eva, who had died from cancer in 1952 at age 33. Her popularity was such that 8 persons were trampled to death in the tumultuous crowds who flocked to see her embalmed body lying in state. According to Manning, the relationship between Bormann and Perón became somewhat frayed around the edges after Perón left for Panama and then exile in Spain in 1955. But Gestapo Müller today, 1981, still wields power with the Argentinian secret police in all matters concerning Germans and the Nazis in South America. The impact of transplanted Nazis continues to be felt in South America. Those aging fascists accomplished much of what the Odessa strategists had hoped, noted Georg Hodel, adding, "The Nazis in Argentina kept Hitler's torch burning, won new converts in the region's militias, and passed on the advanced science of torture and death squad operations. Hundreds of left-wing Peronist students and unionists were among the victims of the neo-fascist Argentine junta that launched the Dirty War in 1976. SS Hauptsturmführer Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, after working for the U.S. Army's Counterintelligence Corps following Germany's defeat, ensconced himself in Bolivia under the name Klaus Altmann. Using his contacts in the Kameradenwerk, he began running guns between Bolivia, Peru, and Chile. The gun trade eventually led them into the drug trade," wrote Lavenda. On July 17, 1980, Barbie abetted right-wing officers in the army during a coup over the left-of-center Bolivian government. Barbie's team hunted down and slaughtered government officials and labor leaders, while Argentine specialists flew in to demonstrate the latest torture techniques, wrote Hodel. With Barbie's aid, Bolivia was soon a primary and secure source of cocaine for the emerging Medellin drug cartel. 2 years later, Barbie was captured and extradited to France, where he died in 1991 from cancer while serving a life sentence for crimes against humanity. Odessa also turned to gun running as a means of financing its operations. In fact, it was never intended only as an escape route for Nazis, but, at Bormann's instructions, it was set up as a profitable business enterprise as well. The plentiful supply of surplus arms in Europe turned out to be an immediately profitable commodity. In late 1945, U.S. military authorities became aware of a huge black market enterprise being operated out of Passau, a picturesque city located 90 miles northeast of Munich at the confluence of the Danube, Inn, and Ilz rivers. It was a connecting point between Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia, and a collection center for Axis arms. It was here that the weapons from 3 complete armies, the Hungarian 5th Army and the German 5th and 12th Armies, were stockpiled in an American-run depot. Rifles, machine guns, and ammunition were gathered at Passau, while millions of dollars worth of vehicles were cached at Mattinghofen, Austria. About $10 million worth of these war materials went missing, sold by black marketeers, mainly Odessa agents, German officials, and criminals, aided by a few Allied soldiers. In one of the greatest ironies of history, the bulk of this material was being shipped to Palestine for use both by Jews trying to create the State of Israel and by Arabs who violently opposed such an effort. On January 5, 1946, U.S. military intelligence officers, under the command of Colonel William Weaver of General Patton's G2 staff, were sent to Passau to make arrests. Instead, the agents were murdered, and the house in which they were staying was burned. One agent, Lieutenant William H. Spector, survived. Hospitalized with a kidney stone, Spector narrowly missed the massacre at Passau. Vowing to avenge his slain fellow officers, Spector was nonplussed to find that the entire affair was hushed up on orders of superior officers who declared it a security issue. Spector did learn that one of the men involved with the stolen arms, as well as the agents' deaths, was a Romanian national named Robert Abramovici. Abramovici later changed his name to Robert Adam and started an arms company called Intermezzo Socomex, which became closely associated with the CIA's arms company, InterArmco. The arms deals in Palestine were handled by Joseph Baidas and Eduardo Berudi and his brothers, who sold weapons to both Arabs and Jews. Berudi later became a vice president of Intrabank, based in Beirut, Lebanon, a major conduit for black market funds. Millionaires were made immediately after the war by both war surplus and black market arms deals. But none were to achieve the profitability of Odessa, whose agents ranged throughout Europe and even behind the Iron Curtain, explained Manning, adding, "They bought and sold surplus American arms to Arab buyers seeking to strengthen the military capabilities of Egypt and other Middle Eastern Arab nations. Palestine was to be partitioned into a Jewish homeland, and they intended to destroy it at birth. But now, Jewish buyers, funded from America and elsewhere, entered the marketplace. They were barred from purchasing guns and American surplus P-51 Mustang fighter planes by President Truman, and their only resource for survival was to trade on the European black market, which, unknown to them, was rapidly coming under the control of Odessa agents. However, the Jewish agency's buyers might have purchased from the devil himself if it meant survival of the small, defenseless nation just come into being on May 14, 1947.